This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Matthew David Wilder. Matthew, it's great having you on the show.
Great to be here, guys.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on, and Matthew, I'm excited to talk to you today.
Did you say that your last name has a von in it?
I added the von.
So it's like Lars von Trier.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's funny because Lars von Trier also sort of has like a semi, like, I have like a, my dad is Jewish, and I think Lars von Trier like thought his dad was Jewish or something. And then he added,
love of Hitler.
What was that?
Hence his love of Hitler.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Because it's funny. He has that whole, there was that whole debacle in a couple years ago at Cannes. And I was watching that, and I was like, it's kind of funny, because I oddly enough relate to him in my own weird way.
At first I was like, oh, everyone's kind of misinterpreting him because he's just fucking with people and like having them on. And then I watched the tape, and it was like, he's kind of serious, actually.
when you have a mixed up identity, sometimes you can think really weird thoughts. So yeah, the von, it's like I sort of Germanicize myself in the same way that he did. So
nice. Or Dracula eyes yourself.
Exactly.
So Matt or Matthew, whichever, what do you prefer?
I like Matthew. That's my version of von.
Okay.
Matthew. Yeah.
So, Matthew, you're a director and a screenwriter. Can you talk about your story, how you got into film? You grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a kind of, I don't know, interesting roundabout, I don't know if it's that interesting, but kind of a roundabout path. I grew up very low rent. I grew up in a trailer park in Des Plaines, Illinois, which is kind of adjacent to where the airport is. If you've ever flown through Chicago, it's sort of a big abyss next to the O'Hare Airport. And I went to college at Yale. I met the great theater and opera director, Peter Sellers, who was sort of a childhood mentor of mine and got me into theater. And, you know, one of his things was he would come and talk to students, and he said, you know, the great thing about theater that's different from film is you can make something tomorrow. You and your friends can go do Hamlet and produce it in a parking lot and for no money, and you can create something great. And so we did that. My friends and I did that quite a lot. We did sort of low-budget productions that were, you know, short rehearsal times, not a lot of money. And so I got into the theater doing that. Eventually, I started writing screenplays and got an agent, moved to Los Angeles, wrote for a bunch of different directors, Oliver Stone, Clive Barker, a bunch of different people. And
was that for a Hellraiser film?
No, it was an adaptation of a play that he wrote called History of the Devil. Which is, if you've never read it, it's a brilliant play about the devil makes a bet with the human race on Earth and says, if you can prove that I ever influenced events in an evil way, I'll get lost. I'll never bother you guys again. But if not, you have to take me to my father's house and I get to take over the business, meaning I go to heaven. You know, and I get to take over, you know, I get to do a hostile takeover on my father, God. So he has this sort of epic OJ trial in the desert of Africa, where you go through the entire history of human events and you see the devil interfering and sort of toying with mankind from like prehistory to the Holocaust. It's fantastic. Now, why people didn't buy that as a movie, I don't really know, but it's quite a brilliant piece. And Clive is, I don't know if you guys know him, but he is a really brilliant guy. Very learned, really a genius.
And you also worked with Oliver Stone?
Yeah.
What was that?
I worked with Oliver. It was funny. It was sort of an ideal job because I got to I got to work with Oliver right after 9/11, which was like, you know, what would be a better therapy for you after 9/11 than getting to hang out with Oliver Stone? I mean, that to me was sort of like, you know, if there was one person you wanted to talk about that stuff with, you know, he's the guy. And he had conceived of a sort of war on terror movie that was going to be, I don't even know quite how you describe it. It was kind of an epic action movie. It was sort of like epic in the way that like Alexander is an epic, but it was, you know, spies and people shooting people and Jason Bourne stuff. And he had great ideas, and it sort of ballooned out of control a little bit. It got longer and longer and longer. And I looked around and saw, you know, my entire apartment was filled with books about, like, the history of Libya from, you know, 1200 on and stuff like that. It became very obsessive. And eventually he just passed and did Alexander instead. But it was kind of cool to do that. In that moment, it was very therapeutic.
Well, then he ended up making World Trade Center in 2006.
Right.
The thing about Oliver Stone that always seems kind of strange to me is that he almost seems to be more ambitious than what he actually ends up doing or something. Like he
needs to be, or he means to be.
He has like a huge level of ambition. Like he's always striving to do these really epic projects, but it seems like he doesn't really make them. I mean,
what I think he needs right now is a little bit, I like this work. I don't know if you guys saw Snowden, but I thought it was really pretty good.
I haven't seen that, no.
It's very solid. But I think what he needs a drop of right now is kind of what Schrader did in our Dog Eat Dog, which is he really cut loose and went nuts. And the audience, I think, really responds to that. Like, I love Oliver and I love his stuff, but like the movie W, I think when you watch that trailer, you want it to be that. You want it to be Dr. Strangelove. You don't want an even-handed movie about George Bush. You want him to go to the mattresses. And I think he needs a little bit of that now.
Did Dog Eat Dog, is that going to be released in November?
Yeah, it comes out, I know in L.A. it comes out on the 4th, and it comes out in New York on the 4th as well, playing in Times Square, poetically enough, and then it opens in 10 markets, I think, like a week later.
So is this the first, like, major film you've been a part of? I know you you directed a film in 2008 with Bill Pullman.
I know the movie called Your Name Here, about Philip, sort of a fantasia on Philip K. Dick with Bill Pullman. And it's about what would happen if Philip K. Dick woke up one day and realized he was in a Philip K. Dick novel.
So it's not a literal, like a biography of his life, but it's a story inspired by him. And I noticed you also changed the name of the main character. He goes by a different name. I think it's William... Jay Frick, yeah.
Well, we had this incredible thing. I mean, the Philip K. Dick estate, I guess they're really hell-bent on at some point doing an official authorized Phil Dick autobiography. So they came at our movie, which was, I mean, we made this movie in like a bathtub. And they came at us with all guns blazing. And so we met with these lawyers and, you know, went through all this stuff. And finally I said, look. This, you know, and they would say to us that the film was in some way defamatory of Philip K. Dick because it showed him doing drugs, which, as you know, he wrote like entire books about doing drugs, autobiographical books, not just fiction books. But so finally, Bill Pullman, the guy who played Philip K. Dick, and I said, you know what? Why don't we just do the Mad Magazine version of it, where everyone has that name that's like one spelling off of what it actually is, and you make him William J. Frick, and everyone else was sort of that too. They were like the Mad Magazine version of whoever they were supposed to be. In the original, everybody was just themselves, and, you know, Nixon and, you know, whoever, they were all just themselves. But in that way, they were fictionalized, and you know what? They still came at us anyway.
Oh, really?
Oh,
for,
yeah.
Like likeness, I mean, or something?
For saying that it was somehow, you know, a slander on Philip K. Dick or something. They're a very wealthy estate, and they guard their stuff very jealously. And every time that picture would come, we would have eight little micro distributors who would see it in a festival, and they'd go to pick it up, and then the Dick Estate would fly in and bomb it.
You've worked a lot with Schrader.
No.
Oh, okay. Did his films like Taxi Driver and Mishima, do they make a big impact on you growing up?
Yeah, it's a very funny thing. It's like it was very fortuitous, this connection, because I think everyone who writes has if you're any good, you have some person that you kind of burn a candle to, when you're starting out writing. With screenwriters, most people it's like William Goldman or Robert Towne, someone like that. And for me, it was Schrader. His stuff really spoke to me, and that he calls it the monocular film, which is the one-eyed film, one protagonist alone against the universe. And when you're young, I think especially that's very appealing, that notion of God's lonely man. When I was in college, when I applied to college, I wrote a one-act play called God's Lonely Man. That's sort of ironic enough that I wound up with this guy. But yeah, he's a huge inspiration. I think because of all the writers of that generation, he was the most individual, I think the most uncompromising, had ideas that were in some ways very high concepts, but also really kind of brutal and strange.
What about John Milius? I feel like he's
John
of that ilk.
I like too. He's that's sort of a different tradition, which is he's that classic, Hemingway, Kipling,
kind
of tall tale, machismo, elephant gun dude, which is awesome. I mean, he's incredibly great. But I think Schrader's gloom was a little more to my taste when I was a youth.
Yeah.
What's interesting is you brought up the book with the film Your Name Here, and both kind of Taxi Driver and Blade Runner are kind of in that neo-noir genre, and I think you mentioned somewhere that you were fascinated with that genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, of noir?
A noir, and then there's like film noir, and then there's like neo-noir, which I guess everything, if anything like from the last 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting. We had a conversation about this when at the Cinematheque we showed Schrader's Blue Collar, and we were talking about what is noir, and he was saying he views it as a historical period. It's like saying Cubism or Expressionism or something. It starts in 1918, it ends in blank. But to me, it's a little more fungible than that, because when you think about it, noir, what is it? It's a visual style on one hand. It's a certain kind of story about fate hanging over these characters. They're sort of the prisoners of their appetites, their lusts. It's not sort of just, it's, I feel like it's a genre that you can't quite pigeonhole too easily, the way you can a Western or a musical or a comedy. It's a little more fungible than that. So it always tickled me when Doggy Dog was first announced. There'd be these articles saying LA neo noir Dog Eat Dog. And I was sort of like, is this a noir? It's a crime movie. If you think Straight Time is a noir, okay.
But people I know were saying that about the film Drive as well.
About Drive?
Yeah, that was like, they're calling that a neo noir.
I don't know. I guess in a way it's like romantic that a lonely guy drives around at night. I guess. I don't know. I don't know that the story of Drive really stacks up as a noir.
I guess there's the style of noir, like the image of noir on one side of it, and then on the other side you have the themes of noir.
Right.
And I think it's something that people are attracted to because it's dark, it's mysterious, it's romantic. And there's just something about like a city late at night with fog and a person walking alone that I think really, when people are in the cinema, they get seduced by that. There's something like very seductive about just those images. And I think, marketers want to capitalize on that. Like noir is something that is catchy. People like that. They get seduced by the idea.
You know, it was a movie, can I just say, that really bugged me was Sin City.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was actually just thinking of that when I was when I was going
well, saying I felt that. Like, you know, the thing that bugged me about that movie was I felt like it was like a very adolescent approach to noir. It was like noir made by someone who had lived no life. You know what I mean? Like, everything in it just seemed like a video game. It didn't, like, when you see the original 40s and 50s noirs, they seem like they were made by guys who lived through the Depression and World War II and got drunk and beat their wives. And you know what I mean? Like, they feel like they were made by genuinely fucked up people, and that's why they were genuinely fucked up stories.
Yeah.
Because they were imbued with that life.
Well, it's
that's the guy who wrote our thing. Eddie Bunker was a guy who was in San Quentin for 25 years. And I saw Sin City, and I was like, this is like some video game nerdlinger's version of noir. Yeah. I don't know.
Do you have an interest in kind of combining different genres? Like you mentioned, well, that one you worked on with Clive Barker that sounded like a kind of horror slash a dark comedy. But like fusionism, like maybe a comedy, a horror, science fiction novel, like all rolled into one.
Yeah, I mean, it's why I've always, you know, I know people, I have friends who are like super into genre movies, and they like making genre movies, and I like genre movies too. But the thing is, I always feel kind of hemmed in by the rules of genres. And they do have rules. They still do. Even Tarantino movies that are in genres have rules. And I think to me, like, the most interesting movies are generally ones that you don't really know what genre they are. Like, what shelf would you put them on in the video store? I don't know. You know, Altman's Three Women. What is it?
Yeah.
Definitely. Is it a women's movie? Is it a horror movie? I mean, like, I don't know what do you call that? You know, the things that escape the boundaries, I guess.
Or like Putney Swope by Robert Downey Sr. Yeah. It's just,
yeah, I mean, that's in the comedy section, but, you know, is it just that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some directors, like someone like Joe Dante, who he's like an expert of making genre films. Like, he can just take the idea of a genre and make a film like that. But, I mean, I think after the 60s, this whole, like, auteur thing, you basically, with people who are, like, conscious directors, and not just, like, you know, studio drones, I think you have genre people, and then, like, auteur people. People who have, like, a vision from themselves, and then people that are, like, trying to pay tribute to, like, a genre.
Recently, Schrader was on Bret Easton Ellis' podcast, and he had a lot of praise for you.
Oh, did he? Someone said, oh, he mentioned you on the Brett thing, and I haven't heard it yet.
Was no, good? I didn't hear it either. I just read it just recently.
Oh, really? I like Brett Ellis' podcast. He's very preachy, but he usually sparks people to some good stuff, so I look forward to that.
Yeah, I listened to Bret Easton Ellis' podcast when it first started, because I think it was free. I think now you have to pay for it. But what I liked about I think it was on like Podcast One, like some site, and a couple years ago, 2014, I would go and listen to it, and then about a year ago, I tried to check it out and had to pay. Maybe it's free now. I haven't tried to go on the site, but what I liked about it was just how honest he was. I think you don't really hear a lot of people who are in show business or, you know, whatever, have opinions that are outside of, you know, what's accepted. And I kind of liked that he was one of the first, basically he was one of the first people that was like cattle prodding at political correctness, at least in the last couple of years. And I respect
him
for
that. What's cool about him is he's not someone who you can sort of pigeonhole ideologically. Like, he doesn't fit into the mold as either like a liberal or a conservative. He's like a free thinker.
Yeah, I like him a lot. I just like he said one thing recently that just kind of bugged me, which is if you heard the one that's with Tarantino, he said like he was talking about like, oh, everybody thinks TV is better than movies now, but you know, I've seen these movies that do things that movies can do that nothing else can do, and he cited like Mission Impossible 5, Jason Bourne, and something else like that. And I was like, that's what you're going to use as your ammunition for what's better than TV?
Well, here's the thing, though. Tarantino is also like that. Like, if you check out his lists, you know, every year he'll put out, like, top 10 movies.
Yeah.
They're always so weird. He'll put, you know, I remember he had, like, Night and Day with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz was, like, number 3 in, like, 2010. Like, it's right. They're always, like, these, like, really mainstream movies. And
right.
Bret Easton
and
Ellis...
cut off as worst film of the year, which I was like, dude, you need to watch more movies if you...
who directed Meek's Cut Off again? It's a female director. What's her name?
Kelly Reichardt. It's like her... You know, deconstructed Western, and you know, maybe it's not your favorite movie of the year, but it's not the worst movie of the year.
I think Kelly Reichardt is a really interesting artist. I mean, I loved Old Joy, and I loved Wendy and Lucy. I haven't seen Meek's Cut Off yet, but I think she does something interesting. But what I don't get about someone like Tarantino, who I obviously think is an intelligent person, is I feel like he would watch something like Meek's Cut Off and just be like, nah, yeah, it's too arty, yeah. and then he'll watch Night and Day with Tom Cruise and be like, oh, this is so good. It's like Bogart and Bacall, you know, with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. Your energy is so great. Like, it's just like, I don't get that way. I don't get it. Is he just a contrarian?
I know. I don't get it either. But, you know, there's people in LA that I know who, you know, they go to the New Beverly every night and watch, like, you know, Gleaming the Cube and Just One of the Boys, you know, 10 times in a row. Or you know, whatever, Saw 4 or something. I don't know. But they've never seen, you know, Bringing Up Baby.
Yeah, yeah.
So, go figure. I don't know.
You have a film coming out, Morning Has Broken. It's still in a pre-production. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a really macabre tale. And I, you know, again, I'm just telling you about the Philip K. Dick of it all. I won't go into the real life names, but if anybody cares, you could, you know, Google for about 10 seconds and figure out, you know, what this is about. I knew a girl a few years ago who told me the story. She said, oh, you probably know this guy who I used to know. He was an Academy Award winning film composer, and he composed an Academy Award winning song. And she met this guy. She was a very attractive young girl. She was a teenage runaway, and he met her in a bar and somehow figured out that she was sort of a you know, on the run and didn't really have anywhere to go, and said, come to my house and you can stay with me. I'm an old lonely guy. I had prostate cancer. My dick doesn't work. So, you know, I can't harm you. So come and stay at my house. And of course she said, you know, what are you talking about? I'm not going to go with you. And he sort of cajoled her. And so she went into this guy's house, and very soon after he sort of, you know, he controlled her through money and, you know, giving her a place to stay and so on. But he got into this very strange psychodrama with a very codependent thing where, before he was an Academy Award winning composer, he was a jingle writer, like Barry Manilow in the 70s. And so every night he would make her stay in, and they would sit, and he would play a giant reel-to-reel tape deck and would play like chicken pot pie jingles. And then he'd say, okay, now let's talk about how the music and the words work together to create meaning, and you know, like that. And then he'd replay this 10-second jingle over and 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 make her talk about it as if it was Mozart. And it was like some kind of weird – it's a little like Patty Hearst in a way, you know? It's like some sort of weird –
Stockholm Syndrome kind of?
Stockholm Syndrome, yeah. So with that, I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that's the first 15 minutes of the movie is that kind of twistedness. And then what happens is so fucked up and so, I mean, will just blow your mind in terms of how far it goes. And it's all true. People who read this script, you know, the first people who read this said, Wilder, this is the, you've done it. You've gone too far. You know, like this is so disgusting.
So you wrote it and directed it.
I wrote it and I'm directing it. It's, all I'll say is just when you see this movie, the twistedness, it's really not all me. A lot of it is just life.
Who's in the film?
Lydia Hurst. Maybe that's why I'm thinking of Patty Hearst, who is Patty's daughter, plays the girl. And the dude is played by Peter Bogdanovich.
Oh, whoa. Awesome.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, I think people said to me, oh, it's cool, you know, both of these people have resonances of the 70s and of another era around them, and, you know, which lends it a sort of Sunset Boulevard quality. And that is true, but they are both fantastic. And Bogdanovich has never had this size of a part in anything.
Well, he was on The Sopranos, I know.
He's on The Sopranos. I mean, he had a long arc, but I mean, this is a thing where he's like in every scene and doing things that will blow your mind. You'll be like, I never thought I would see the day when I saw a scene of Peter Bogdanovich doing that movie. I'll just leave that.
So what films have inspired this film? Like, are you the kind of artist that's like that? Because I know, like, Gaspar Noé, it almost seems like his movies, like something like Enter the Void is like a Jordan Belson movie combined with that Gerard Cargill movie, Angst. And, like, it's just like a mashup of those two. Do you do that? Are you that sort of filmmaker where you have other movies in your mind that you're thinking about when you're filming?
You know, I was talking to somebody about this the other night. I think that, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me about influences, and you know, I think this is true of most, I think, good filmmakers at least. I think what influences you is not necessarily the obvious thing, which is to say, you know, if you make a crime film, you're influenced by Guy Ritchie, or you're influenced Melville, or something.
That's the problem. That's the problem with Sin City.
Subconsciously.
Well, I just think, like, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, like, I love Woody Allen movies, and I think when you see the movie Dog Eat Dog, you know, there's probably a certain element of something in the dialogue, something in the characters that comes from, you know, Manhattan, or, you know, something like that. Where, you know, of course, it's a movie about a bunch of thugs riding around in a Pinto, but I think the way things influence you, it's not all that one-to-one. I think it's like a mulch.
Yeah, you know, that's...
As far as, like, aesthetics go, like, do you have a particular, like, eras in history and particular, like, locales and geographic locations that really fascinate you?
Well, you know, I think, like, most people who like movies who are of my generation, it's like, I grew up with the 70s, and the American 70s, and I grew up with the European 60s. So when I was a kid, I watched, you know, Altman, Scorsese, Cassavetes, and Bergman, Fellini, Buñuel, Fassbender, all that kind of stuff. And it was a little bit later that I, you know, it's like I still to this day, there's you know, William Wyler movies I haven't seen, and John Ford movies I haven't seen, and, you know, so I'm filling in now the first, you know, let's say 1930 to 1960 U.S. cinema, and that's what really fascinates me now. I don't understand, when I see people who, like, watch, you know, Lucio Fulci movies over and over, I'm like, oh, you gotta be kidding me, there's so many good films out there that you haven't watched. I don't know why people spend their time on that kind of crap.
Oh, so you think like, watching, like, Argento and stuff like that?
I love Argento, but like, you know, enough's enough. You know, oh. I think if you've seen those things once or twice.
I think I can tell you why that happens. I feel like I'm maybe one of those people. It's like, I love a film like Autumn Sonata by Ingmar Bergman. That's one of my favorite movies. But great, it's film. Like, it takes effort for me to watch it. It's like...
Really?
It doesn't take effort, but it's like, it's an investment in a way. Like, while watching Dawn of the Dead isn't as much.
Well, I like Dawn of the Dead. I mean, look.
I love Dawn of the Dead. Those are in my top 10, both of those movies.
I like those movies, too, and I watch them, too. But I got to say, there is something, and I don't know if you guys ever feel this, but there's something now. When I watch a movie from, you know, 1942, and there's that rhythm of somebody, it's a little bit from theater. Someone enters a room. They talk. You're over this shoulder. You're over that shoulder. Then you give a wide. Then you go back. Then they walk out. There's something about that rhythm versus the rhythm of post-Michael Bay fragmentation, blow your face off, that I find very centering. You know, like it is like
It's almost like
your breath calms down a little bit. I don't mean like it's putting me to sleep, but it's sort of like, oh yeah, this is what life is supposed to be like.
Yeah, I mean, I recently watched To Be or Not To Be, the Ernst Lubitsch film.
Lubitsch, yeah.
Yeah, and that was, like, I don't really, you know, because I'm 26 years old, and I was a film buff for a really long time, and I sort of faded out of it, and, like, I think I'm sort of coming back, like, I'm sort of forcing myself to, you know, appreciate again, and, like, when you're young and you grow up in, like, the kind of era we're in now, it's like a lot of people I know don't want to watch black and white movies. You know, they it's like you sort of have to retrain your brain when you grow up in, like, I grew up in the Michael Bay era. You know, I have to retrain my brain. Like,
if you walk down the street and you were reading, you know, Dickens, David Copperfield, people wouldn't look at you funny. If you go to a gallery and look at a Rembrandt painting, people aren't going to say, God, that's weird. But if you watch a 1935 film, people are like, oh, my God, what's wrong with you? You know, like, that's so weird.
Yeah, that is true. And I just look like,
that's good. It's good.
Do you see it as crucial to sort of break taboos in film and to kind of, in a sense, traumatize the audience by taking them out of their comfort zone?
I have to say, I would like to say no, but I think I have to say yes. I feel like there's something about that that is very, it's invigorating. It's like, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to do that. And I don't know about you guys. I really like sometimes also very difficult films. Like you have to kind of sit in your chair and like work at it a little bit. I like that. I don't like everything to be a hand job. I like something be like, you have to come to it a little bit. That's one way of doing that.
Have you seen Angst? Yeah. The Gerard Targo film, Angst?
Yeah, I have seen Angst.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good difficult movie.
Missing
the brutality
movie.
Of it. I mean, I think like the way it's filmed, it's almost like a roller coaster ride. Really easy. But just in like witnessing just brutality for, you know, an hour and a half, I think that's kind of difficult.
Yeah,
for me at least.
but it's like a very beautifully staged movie too.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's full of great style. But I was thinking of like a movie like Jean Dielman, you know, the Chantal Ackerman movie about the a housewife.
Oh.
Kind of slowly cat. Movie? It's like, very long.
Yeah, where it's just like someone, cooking eggs for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So,
literally.
Are you like a Bellatar fan then?
I'm a Bellatar fan. I saw Jean Dielman one time at UCLA, and two-thirds of the way into the movie, the film broke. And I cannot tell you how angry that – I mean, that was like a Trump rally. Like, people were going to fucking kill somebody if they didn't ditch that – we didn't get to the end of that fucking movie because we sat here for 3 hours, and then in the middle of the eggs
– Yeah. You don't know if she's gonna make an omelet or it's like I also if you're gonna talk about difficult movies, I mean, I like stuff like Michael Snow sometimes. Like, you ever seen that one where it's just like he's burning photographs, and each photograph he burns, like he describes the next one.
Yeah.
So it's just like he's burning a picture of like a woman, like, you know, I don't know, cooking eggs. And then like while that one's burning, he's like, oh, and here's another image of her standing outside. And then the eggs go away. Then the one of her standing outside is there. And that one sets on fire. And he just explains what the next one's going to be.
You're working on a film, and this one you're the writer for. And this one is starring Nicolas Cage, but it's called The Looking Glass. It's coming out next year in 2017. It's a thriller.
Right. Yeah.
So it's about a couple who buys a desert motel, and they find out a a lot of mysterious things happen. Is it like a, would you say it's a horror film?
It's the dude who produces, a friend of mine named Braxton Pope, who produced Canyons with Schrader. If you remember that movie with Lindsay, and Brady Snellis too, it all interconnects. He had this script, and I just did a bit of work on it. It's about, if you guys remember, I think in maybe 6 months or so ago, Gay Talese wrote this article for The New Yorker about a motel in Vegas where this guy had installed these sort of Norman Bates style peepholes so he could watch people fucking in the different rooms.
Okay.
And then something, and Gay Talese wrote a long piece on it, but then he discovered that the place was exposed as a hoax, or it, like, they didn't really have the eye holes, or they didn't always have the eye holes, or something like that. So it was exposed as kind of a fraud. But anyway, this other writer had written a piece based on that same motel, which is this movie, Looking Glass. And it's about a guy, Nick Cage, and his wife who have lost a child, and they're sort of trying to start again, and they move to Nevada, and they buy this I guess it's meant to be a little bit outside of Vegas. They buy this motel and discover, and, you know, they just take it over, running it, changing the sheets. And they discover that there's one room that's the room where, you know, the hooker with the snake around her neck goes into. And people go into that room, and strange things happen in that room. And it's sort of like the room is a little bit of a portal, it seems, into something other. And it's very, the movie is very, I think, a little bit Lost Highway-ish. That's sort of the feel of it, is that kind of, is like, I think, like, kind of that period of Lynch. Maybe a little bit of Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting period of David Lynch.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he was sort of, not to veer off the topic so much, but, you know, that's where he kind of had a lot of critical acclaim. He was thrown into the mainstream. And those movies are weird because that's like the most hard-edged and like obvious Lynch is at the same time. I mean, you know what I mean? Because I know like Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet, you can like watch those movies from beginning to end and you can like get what's happening in them. And you right. can't really do that for Fire Walk With Me, Lost Highway, or Mulholland Drive. But there is like a visceral edge that those movies have.
It's funny, I've always thought the one, I mean, to me, the one that really has that is Blue Velvet, and I was a freshman in college, and I went to, took the train into New York on opening day, and all I knew was, oh, this is a new David Lynch movie that's about a young detective boy in a small town. So imagine that's what you think you're going to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Movie. It was honestly the most traumatic experience I've ever had in a movie.
Really? Really?
Oh, I love it. It's one of my favorite films, but it was so great. I mean, it was like the most beautiful girl in the world, like punching you in the face and fucking you at the same time. And it was actually great, which it is. And that movie is great, but it was that kind of thing where you couldn't believe you were seeing this stuff. Like, are you fucking kidding me? This is in a movie?
Wait, were you? Are but you from? You're from New Jersey?
What's that?
Are you from New Jersey?
No.
Oh, okay. Because when you said take the train in,
Alex, you asked that to every single guest.
Not really.
Is it from New Jersey?
Well, you know, there's not. I mean, this is a really densely populated state. It's like, I don't know. People might be
so with the film The Looking Glass, like, I know maybe it's a little bit, the whole sort of motel cliche is a little bit kind of, the whole motel thing's a little bit maybe kind of cliche with all those like horror films, but like I'm personally like a big fan of like a lot of that kind of a mid-century roadside architecture you see like driving to Vegas.
Yeah, I like that too. Do you know, God, what's that town? I always thought this would be a great site for a movie is, what is the have you guys ever driven into Vegas from LA?
Yeah, I have.
Is it Laughlin? Yeah, Laughlin, I think. It's the town that they built for people who are such gambling addicts they can't wait to go to Vegas.
Oh, the one like, right on the border.
Right on the border. Like, right as you cross over, it's like, gambling, you know. And it's so janky, and the places are just so vile. It's like the ugly sister of Vegas, you know.
Yeah.
Ugly,
It's like really sleazy, but it is kind of a, it's kind of like if you're driving like at night, you're driving for the Mojave Desert.
Yeah.
And then you first see like the kind of signage, and it's very like 70s, and it's kind of like a teaser, like before you get to Vegas, then you drive another half an hour and you finally get there.
Yeah. Yep. I love it. I really love Vegas. I could spend a lot of time there, but I fortunately don't.
But
are you a fan of a lot of the like old vintage Vegas? I know that kind of stuff is being like torn down.
You know, it's funny. I was my movie, the Phil Dick movie, it premiered in a festival in Vegas, and I stayed there for like a week. I was like, oh fuck it, I'm going to stay here and watch the movies and, you know, hang out, whatever. And I stayed, you know, to be cheap, I stayed in one of those places that's downtown, like off the strip.
Oh yeah, so did I. The first time I went, I stayed at the Golden Nugget.
Yeah, this is Sub Nugget. This was like, okay. You know, like two blocks off the Nugget. And I thought, oh, this is cool. This is like, you know, this will be like a James Ellroy novel or something like that. And actually, it was just nasty. I mean, it was nasty. And the clam chowder was horrible. And yeah, I don't recommend it. Stick with the Cosmopolitan.
The Cosmopolitan.
They have good commercials, very sexy commercials.
Yeah, I think last time I did a whole Vegas show with a rabbit. We stayed at the Flamingo.
Yeah, that's cool.
Anyhow, so you talked to you've made some like political posts on your wall. So obviously you're not a fan of Donald Trump, but you've also said some things interesting about the Democratic Party, about how it's sort of become like a puppet of like the corporations and Wall Street. You've been on the kind of the left like most of your life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like at this point, doesn't it just sort of feel like everything's melting a little bit? Like, I consider myself on the left, you know, in terms of most sort of the, like what I consider like the sort of hard issues, but I also am sympathetic to like the, you know, what you're describing, like Brady Snow saying, like, you know, political correctness, like even that phrase seems kind of stale to me now, but I guess what bothers me is sort of like the obsession with micro issues, the obsession with sensitivity.
So you're more kind of like old school left issues like raising the minimum wage and stuff like that, as opposed to like the whole SJW thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's funny. There's you know, like, I try to sort of always be a little bit off, you know, kind of off the beat, I think, a little bit. Because, like, I see people who, I don't agree with this either, you know, people who respond to those, as you call it, SJW things, like manospheric stuff and things like that.
Yeah.
It feels very reactive. It's like, oh, you say this, so I'm going to say something that's three times more obnoxious, you know, that's in reverse. And I sort of go, you know, you don't really believe. Do you really believe that? You know, like.
Well, there's a lot of LARPing.
Really, you know, what's that?
There's a lot of like LARPing, like live action role playing, and I think it's on both sides.
I think that's true, but I mean, it's like, I think, you know, some of that alt-right stuff is like, I know some of those people, and I'm kind of like, I think they're kind of punking you a little bit, like, you know. That's why I think some of the more egghead Trump followers, like that guy Milo Yiannopoulos, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's sort of a delight in just sort of fucking with pearl-clutching kind of bourgeois liberals. Oh, yeah.
Milo's like a troll before he's anything else.
Yeah. He's very funny, though.
Yeah, I mean, funny. I think that, like, trolls and, like, troll culture, like, I think it's important to have that. And that's like being a critic of society. And, right. I mean, I think that's the role that artists have to play, and I think that's why a lot of art has been stale for the last, you know, 10 years, maybe even longer than that, because it hasn't offered like a true criticism to, you know, the mainstream, to contemporary society. I haven't seen a lot of art that's been really critical. Like, I thought True Detective kind of was, like the first season at least.
Critical. Of what?
Like Matthew McConaughey's character, he just almost comes like from a Schopenhauer perspective. He's like a nihilistic guy, and you know, it was it was like against the kind of like universal moralism that's like just thrown at us. Just seeing someone that negative.
Those movies are
very old though. I just mean in the last 10 years or so. Like the first season of True Detective, like having that kind of nihilism, I thought was really refreshing, because even something like that, I just don't see a lot of it in the mainstream.
I can say I liked a lot about season two of True Detective, and it obviously had like some very embarrassing.
Oh, I like season two a lot too.
I like it too. It's really hated.
Yeah, I don't know why.
You know this guy Frank Mingarelli? He's a podcast film person as well, and he's a super fan of that, particularly of that season, and has written tomes about how great that season is. And I don't think it's all great, but I do think there's some really beautiful things in it. That there's this great sequence with this John Adams music when Rachel McAdams is walking around that hooker convention.
Oh yeah, that was amazing.
Oh, it's incredible! It's like it's awesome. And like this is just incredible filmmaking.
Yeah, there is like the almost like what is that guy Godfrey Reggio who made like the thing I like about season two is that it has that kind of Koyaanisqatsi type like there's just the shots of the city and it like seems organic. And
well, I got the one thing that bugged me about season two was other than that like the Lynchian. Coffee shop where the girl sings "This is my worst life."
Oh, you didn't like that? I sort of liked it.
I thought it was a little silly, but
the kind of twitty part was cool, though.
Just one thing I thought it's kind of weird about what Pete Salazzo, whatever his name is like he can't get L.A. And I got to tell you, L.A. is like a city that's not hard to get on film. Like to convey what it is like is not. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to get it, and he missed it totally. And like he was trying to do Vernon, Vernon is like this industrial town within LA that has like no people in it. It's just like park trucks. That's like where Vince Vaughn's whole thing was going down, and all that. It's a really interesting part of LA, and it felt to me so fake in that show. I just felt like they missed it.
Well, I'm an LA native, and like a city like a San Francisco, it's very compact, and people have this kind of there's this kind of romanticized touristy vision of the city, because LA is like spread out. It has so many places that are extremely different from one another. I mean, you have like suburban Pacific Palisades, you have like the Sunset Strip, West Hollywood area, where you are. Then you have like downtown LA. And you have these places like Vernon. There's just so much variety because it's so spread out.
Oh yeah, that's what I love about the city. Is like it just literally, as you drive around, it just changes. It's like it changes planets from one block to another.
Was it a culture shock at first when you first moved there?
It was. I lived in New York for a year, and after school, and I came out to go to directing school in San Diego, and I drove from LA to. I drove from New York to LA. And I stayed at a friend of mine, Matt Henderson, who's a great actor, stayed at his parents' house in Sherman Oaks. And a friend of mine was driving the car at the time. I was like taking a nap in the back seat. And I remember like looking up and honestly seeing, driving down a street and seeing rows of palm trees. And it blew I was like, no way. They don't really actually have palm trees on every street, like lining the whole street. But they do. And, that's like a commonplace now. But as somebody from the Midwest, that was like surreal, to me that the city was like that. And I just instantly felt like at home here.
You had some comment on Facebook that you said a lot of the West Hollywood roid heads are getting on your nerves.
Oh my God. They are. I live in a land of roids, and these guys are really loud and they bang the at the gym, they like drop the weights
like the kind of like the reality show character stereotype.
I guess they're just oafs, and they're everywhere.
Are they the tech bros that I hear about in California?
What
the tech bros.
I don't know. I don't know the tech bros so much. My young woman lives in San Francisco, and so you know they have to deal with them there. Here, not so much. I will say, you know, the one thing that really sucks about LA, and I love LA, but the one thing that really bugs me is it's the worst place in America for overheard conversation. Like when you go to New York, if you're just sitting in a Starbucks or something and you just hear what people are talking about, it's often interesting or funny or something like that. In LA, never.
What do you mean? It's vapid?
Oh, it just makes you want to poke your eyeballs out or kill them.
Yeah. I can relate to that. I mean, I live in Santa Barbara, but I'm an LA native and I've lived there most of my life.
Do you feel that way when you come here?
Yeah, definitely. I only go there about like twice a year now, but that's definitely accurate.
Well,
what's that?
Oh, I mean, I'm from over in like New York area, and I want to poke my eyes out a lot of times now, especially like, you know, the thing is, there's a lot of stuff going on in New York, and you know, if you hear an annoying conversation, you can always just eavesdrop on another one, but there's been this weird, like, homogenization. Like, if you go over to, I don't know if you've been over to, like, Williamsburg recently, it just looks like a mall. 10 years ago, it really, you know, it was, you know, there maybe was, like, an American Apparel or something, but there was just a lot of, like, it was, like, on its way to becoming something, like, gentrified or whatever, but now it's just, like, a full mall, and it's just full of, like, you know, vapid Swipple types.
I was surprised last time I went to a dinner in Williamsburg, and we went to some, I don't know, some sort of foodie restaurant or something, and I sat there and I looked around and I was like, this is like all old people. Like, wasn't this supposed to be like Lena Dunham hipsters like at one juncture? Now it was all like old rich people.
Yeah,
I guess they pushed the hipsters out. Now it's all like the uber rich.
Yeah, it like died out. I mean, the whole thing is like, you know, maybe around 2001, 2002, a lot of young people were moving over there. But just something happened around 2007 where like that hipster culture went mainstream. And I think like the current political correctness, like, had a lot, like, the huge, huge snowballing of it. I think a lot of it had to do with, like, the hipster culture becoming mainstream, and, like, everyone trying to be cosmopolitan, and everyone trying to
be... Yeah, so now all the roid heads are, like, hipsters now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that word hipster, like, I was thinking about this the other day, I was like, you know, 5 years ago, it was so clear, like, what kind of annoying person that meant, and now I was like, I don't even know if that word means anything anymore.
Yeah,
it just means white person who went to college under 40. Like, I don't know what does it mean?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I think part of this whole, like, you know, opening up of, like, you know, people are eating better. You know, they're concerned about, like, oh, I want to get my fair trade coffee or whatever. And they're, like, dressing better. It's easier to buy, like, you know, more fashionable clothes are cheaper or whatever. But there's just something like, it's like this store-bought authenticity. Like, people like want to buy authenticity, and it's becoming so blatantly obvious how fake it is. You know,
well, nobody young goes through that crust punk phase anymore, really, do they? It's like that's so unhealthy. They're taught to be so healthy that like they would never,
you know,
cigarettes and pizza for 3 years or something like that anymore. I don't know. Seems that way.
When I was in college, you know, those people were, when I would go to like the noise shows or like punk shows or whatever, there were a lot of people like that. And this was around maybe 2010. But what happened was over time, like the younger generations didn't replace the older generations. It wasn't like generation one of crust punks, okay, the new ones are coming in. It was just like crust punks, all right, normal kids. And just waves and waves of normal kids.
I felt that drop off around 2007.
Yes, exactly.
I come from theater. I used to direct theater. And when I was young, we did these shows, and you know, like I say, we do shows on a parking garage or on a rooftop or something like that. And I did a show right after I directed Your Name Here. I went to Cal Arts to direct a play. I was just like, oh fuck it, I'll do this play. It was in a big, huge space. They had a lot of money, and so it was fun. But I did it, and it was really strange. There was a definite change in the air, which was, you know, undergraduate kids who previously would go, oh, wow, this is really weird. Wow, weird theater, cool. All right, where do I sign up? No, suddenly everyone, it was like post-American Idol. Everyone wanted to be a star, and everyone wanted it to be about them, and everyone wanted to be the lead. And that kind of ensemble, it just stopped. And you just felt like something in the air changing. I don't know what it was.
MySpace generation, too.
What is it's people just sort of valuing fame just for kind of like wanting that narcissistic supply as opposed to the actual substance of the work.
It's the MySpace generation. You know, it's like the idea of being a micro celebrity. Like, I can go on Facebook and I can post a cool picture of myself and get a ton of likes and write a funny status and people will like it. And it's like, you can elevate yourself within a group of people and everyone kind of wants to be like the celebrity in their sphere of friends. And I think that that happened around 2007 because, you know, my stuff like that's when Facebook became more open to the general public as well.
Do you think that is changing? Like, do you think like the younger siblings of those people are different from that, or do you think it's just going to get worse?
I think like what's going to happen is, you know, not to get like too postmodern, but Jean Baudrillard said that, you know, when this digital simulation happens, we're just going to have to like accept it and evolve with it. So I think like that's what happened. Like, we had a little bit of like an awkward growing phase with this constant media thing, and in a couple years we're going to adjust to it and like know how to use it in a way that like actually benefits our lives.
I'll just say this, you know, if you ever read my posts, I break the balls of the youth of America often, but I actually like a lot of people who are young. But there's one thing that people do now, the youth of America, that really just, you know, sticks in my craw, which is saying, if you mention some, I don't know, a book or a movie or something, saying, oh, I don't know that was before my time.
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
I'm like, hey, Shakespeare was before my time, motherfucker, but, you know, I read that too.
Well,
you know what I mean? It's like, well, yeah. What kind of excuse is that?
Well, the thing is, I mean, before, when you were talking about screenwriters, you were saying, like, Paul Schrader was your guy, but you're like Robert Towne, or who was the other person you mentioned?
William Goldman.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, I you know, when I was, like, a younger guy, and I was, you know, in high school, and I was like, oh, I want to be, like, a director when I'm older, like, so many people do. I was like, oh, well, I have to get the canon down. I have to go and check out a lot of old stuff. And it's like, I mean, while, you know, it's like, I wanted to delve into 70s things and 60s things. And before that, while a lot of other people I knew, it's like, they didn't even go back to Tarantino. You know what I mean? Like, these guys that were like 16, 17 years old in the mid 2000s, it's like, they just liked contemporary artists, and if they went back and like looked at old stuff, it was like never before the early 80s. You know, they just wanted to keep within, like, I don't know what that is. Maybe it has to do with the editing. Well I'm not
but you
sure.
Know, about that, all the people I know who are in their early 20s, like when you play them like 70s, like rock, like play them like Stones or something or Fleetwood Mac, they all like that way more than contemporary music.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, everyone that, I mean, maybe that's just purely anecdotal, but everyone that I know.
No, no, same.
You know, 22, you play them the Stones, and they're like, oh, fuck, this is better than Taylor Swift.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, definitely. I see that as well.
You're saying the whole before my time thing, it's, music's the one exception. It's with film and literature.
Is that because it's more, I don't know, it's more narrative or it's more intellectual or something and less visceral.
That's
definitely true. Also, people, especially younger people who grew up with the internet, like they have a short time frame. So like a song is like 3 minutes maybe, but like a book or a film is a much longer commitment.
Yeah, Bret Easton Ellis was talking about this on his podcast, and I related to it, and I was like embarrassed about relating to it, because he was saying, like, you know, when I go and get an album by an artist, I'll put on track one and listen to track 15 and listen to the entire thing. And, like, I always did that, but in the last couple of years, I've been like, okay, the song I like, listen to it, go to another album, listen to the song I like on that one, go to another artist. Like, I've been way more schizophrenic. And, yeah, I mean, that's something that people need to learn how to do again, is, like, sit down and, like, enjoy a long piece of art. I think it's good for your soul to just zone out.
That, you're saying, and I think you're right, there is this fragmentation of attention, yet at the same time, we have this thing, and I know it's like a cliche to say this now, but it's a true cliche. We have incredible work going on television where people will watch something like Mad Men for 65 hours.
Yeah, that's
weird.
And
a lot of 65 hours are like people staring out a window or looking into space. You know what I mean?
I don't understand that. It's like, you know, let's say you were going to talk about, like, what's that Bellatar movie from 1994, like, Satan Tango? Is that what it's called? It's like, you know, oh, we're going to go, you know, to, you know, Anthology Film Archives and watch Satan Tango. And it's like, oh, I don't want to sit around and watch cows in a field for 20 minutes. But it's right. Like, but you will sit around and watch fucking Gilmore Girls for, like, 6 days straight? I don't get it.
People will sit and watch 12 hours of whatever the fuck, Archer, without blinking. I mean, like, that's as normal as pie. But yeah, you show them like a Bellatar movie that's like 2.5 hours and they'll commit suicide.
Yeah, I think it's the editing. I think it's all in the editing. That must be what it is. Because it's like, if you have a shot that's like, you know, long... You're obviously have much more experience than Robert and I with this. Why do you think people are more willing to watch, let's say, Mad Men, like 6 episodes of Mad Men in a row? Why are they more willing to do that than, let's say, watch, you know, like a Georgios Lanthimos movie like Alps or something like that?
I never thought this, but just thinking it right now as you're saying it, what I think it is that, like, it's not that people can't take duration, it's that they feel this sense of control. Like, when you're watching 6 Mad Men's, you're choosing to gulp down 6 episodes. You don't have to gulp down 6, you could just watch 1 or a half, but when you watch a long movie, you're fucking strapped in for a long movie, and the director is going to make you sit there for 3 hours. So I think it's feeling like you're in control of the experience rather than the experience is tyrannizing you. It's kind of stupid. But
no, I think that's probably true. I think that's what's sort of going on in our culture now, is that, like, the consumer or the viewer or the reader or whoever, the user sort, they want to be in control. You know, they want to have this sort of bottom up, or, you know, way of engaging with media. It's like, it's the user's world, it's the interactive world. And
there was this kind of era, and this is in theater, but you had like a Goethe, and his whole philosophy was that basically, like, the director is kind of like the dictator and he's control of everything. Prior to that, like, actors can kind of do what they want, and now kind of the audience feels like they're the ones in completely control.
You know, I go to see a lot of movies in the theater, and one thing I think is really great about it is it's this thing where you have to shut off your phone, lights go down, and you just get immersed into this experience, and you have to go with the rhythm of whether it's Bellatar or Michael Bay, whatever it is, you have to flow with it. And there's something that feels really great about having 2 hours or whatever in your day where you just give over to that thing. You're not sitting there nervously tapping, you know, hypertexting from one place to another.
You can't do that in your living room, too. You have to do that in the cinema. It's
yeah,
a totally different feeling.
Captive audience in your living room, you could just, like...
You can turn it off.
I mean, don't most people now, like, are, like, living this multi-screen life?
Yeah, it's like they have their TV and
they got the laptop and they got the phone and maybe multiple screens within the laptop. That's, I don't know. It's probably okay. It just, it makes me a little nervous to contemplate that, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting to see where things will end up.
Do you think it's going to just keep fragmenting?
You mean like getting shorter and shorter and shorter?
Shorter and more screens and more shorter and, yeah, well, like more mosquito brain.
Yeah, I mean, I really see happening, like, overall is that people are breaking off, like, into their groups. And I think there are people who will always enjoy going to a theater and sitting down and, like, they like that, and there's other people that are just sort of pleasure seekers. and I think what's happening is, like, I don't really see a mainstream anymore. That's a huge part of it.
I know, I love that.
And exactly, so that's what I'm saying, is that, like, I think for some people,
in some ways, like, the mainstream culture is declining.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, but it gives people freedom to start kind of their own subcultures.
Yeah, so I think that for people who appreciate film, I think they'll always exist, and I think, like, there will just be a community of people who, you know, engage with art and can appreciate art. and I think, like, we can use technology to develop that kind of community.
I think there's a beautiful flip side to this, which is, I know, you know, I've sort of accumulated enough people in different places around the world that, you know, I can go on Facebook and say, hey, has anybody ever heard of this Icelandic filmmaker, you know, XYZ? And in 2 minutes, somebody will, like, post the guy's film.
Yeah.
Not even, like, an article about it. They'll give you a link to the movie.
You're talking about, like, obscure kind of art directors.
Yeah, some obscure movie. Yeah, I mean, whatever. It was something really obscure. And, like, in 2 seconds, some guy from Portugal will go ding, and, like, there it is.
Yeah.
We're at the end of the show. Matthew, is there any? Do you want to, like, plug your upcoming films again?
Yeah. So, Looking Glass is going to shoot at the end of this year and will be released next year. My movie, Morning is Broken, with Lydia Hurst and Peter Bogdanovich, is shooting at the end of this year and will be screened in 2017. And Dog Eat Dog, directed by Paul Schrader, starring Nick Cage and Willem Dafoe, opens on November 4th in LA and New York. It opens on November 11th everywhere else. And then it's going to be on VOD, and you can watch it on your phone.
Matthew, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, guys.
Matt, it's been great talking to you.